the Wright brothers occupy a special place in our collective imagination. Two bicycle mechanics from Ohio who changed the course of human history through sheer determination and ingenuity. Their story has been told countless times, but William Hazelgrove's The Wright Brothers, The Wrong Story challenges the carefully constructed mythology surrounding Orville and Wilbur. This provocative re-examination has garnered attention from aviation historians and casual readers alike, with Neil deGrasse Tyson calling it a refreshing look at the Wright brothers' journey. The book strips away decades of carefully crafted narrative to reveal a more complex truth, that Wilbur Wright was the true visionary behind human flight, while Orville, though talented, played a supporting role in his brother's quest. The story that emerges is not just about invention, but about how history itself is shaped by those who survive to tell it. In 1884, a seemingly minor incident altered the course of aviation history. Wilbur Wright, then 18 years old and planning to attend Yale, was struck in the face with a hockey stick during a game on a frozen pond. The attack knocked out several teeth and sent Wilbur into a 3-year depression. Confined to his home in Dayton, Ohio, he abandoned his college plans and underwent a profound intellectual transformation. During this period of isolation, Wilbur immersed himself in his father's extensive library, systematically educating himself through works ranging from Dickens to Darwin. Though officially a high school dropout, he developed extraordinary knowledge across multiple disciplines. This coincided with his duties caring for his dying mother, creating a crucible that forged his analytical mind. A former schoolmate later observed that Wilbur lives largely in his own world, far above the ordinary plane. This self-imposed exile created the intellectual foundation that would later enable him to solve the complex problem of human flight. When his mother died in 1889, Wilbur emerged from isolation with a mind uniquely prepared to tackle challenges that had defeated the greatest engineers of his time. The hockey stick incident represents one of history's great ironies, a moment of violence that ultimately led to humanity's conquest of the skies. Had Wilbur attended Yale as planned, he might have followed a conventional path, rather than developing the singular focus that would later drive his obsession with flight. His years of solitary study created an autodidact whose approach to problems was unencumbered by conventional academic thinking, precisely what was needed to solve the seemingly impossible challenge of human flight. In August 1896, while nursing his brother Orville through typhoid fever, Wilbur Wright encountered news that would change his life. Otto Lilienthal, the famous flying man of Germany who had conducted over 2,000 glider flights, had died in a crash. Lilienthal's final words, "Sacrifices must be made," and his admonition not to rest until we have obtained a perfect conception of the problem of flight captivated Wilbur's restless mind. This moment marked the beginning of Wilbur's obsession with flight. While caring for Orville, he read extensively about birds and flight mechanics, focusing particularly on wing design and control rather than just power. In May 1899, he wrote to the Smithsonian Institution requesting all available materials on aeronautics, describing himself as an enthusiast but not a crank, and expressing his belief that human flight is possible and practical. The Smithsonian's assistant secretary, Richard Rathbun, responded with a list of recommended readings, including Mouillard's Empire of the Air, Lilienthal's writings, and Langley's Experiments in Aerodynamics. These materials introduced Wilbur to the work of Octave Chanute and Samuel Langley, two figures who would become crucial to his journey, one opening doors of knowledge, while the other would become a rival. What distinguished Wilbur's approach from his contemporaries was his focus on control rather than just power. While wealthy inventors like Hiram Maxim spent fortunes on elaborate machines that crashed spectacularly, Wilbur's financial limitations proved advantageous, forcing him to be methodical and efficient. He recognized that the fundamental problem was not generating enough power to lift an aircraft, but controlling it once airborne. Significantly, in all his correspondence with the Smithsonian, Wilbur used "I" rather than "we," there was no mention of Orville. The quest to fly was initially Wilbur's alone. Orville had no interest at first. Even in letters to his father about going to Kitty Hawk, Wilbur never mentioned his brother. The bishop would later acknowledge that Wilbur had drawn Orville into the flying problem. In September 1900, Wilbur Wright boarded a train out of Dayton, heading alone to the remote eastern seaboard to discover the secrets of manned flight. After a perilous journey that included a harrowing boat crossing, he arrived at the isolated outpost of Kitty Hawk, North Carolina, a place he had selected for its constant winds and soft sand landings. For the locals, Wilbur might as well have been from another planet, always dressed in his Sunday best while working on a mysterious flying machine. He set up a canvas shelter in the yard of William Tate, a local resident who had agreed to host him, and began constructing his glider using borrowed materials and the Tate sewing machine. Wilbur spent hours observing hawks soaring on thermal currents, meticulously documenting their flight patterns. In a letter to his father, he explained his focus was not on powered flight, but on solving the problem of equilibrium, believing that once control was mastered, the motor problem will quickly be solved. Though pursuing flight for pleasure rather than profit, he acknowledged the slight possibility of achieving fame and fortune from it. This solitary pilgrimage reveals much about Wilbur's character and approach. Unlike Samuel Langley, who worked in secrecy with government funding at the Smithsonian, Wilbur was a lone experimenter with minimal resources but maximum determination. His decision to travel to this remote location demonstrated both his commitment and his understanding that flight required specific environmental conditions, steady winds, and forgiving landing surfaces. When Orville eventually joined him, their experiments began in earnest, but it was Wilbur who had laid the groundwork, selected the location, and developed the theoretical approach. This pattern would continue throughout their collaboration, Wilbur providing the intellectual direction, while Orville contributed his mechanical skills. While Wilbur Wright is often portrayed as working exclusively with his brother Orville, his true intellectual partnership was with Octave Chanute, a renowned engineer and aviation pioneer. Their correspondence was extraordinary, 435 letters over a decade, averaging one every 8 or 9 days. These exchanges weren't between Chanute and the Wright brothers, but specifically between Chanute and Wilbur. Chanute, at 64, brought worldly knowledge and scientific expertise that impressed even Bishop Milton Wright, who had mixed feelings about this secular man taking his son's lark seriously. For Wilbur, Chanute represented the intellectual equal he needed, someone who could understand the complex aeronautical problems he was trying to solve. In their correspondence, Wilbur balanced openness with growing paranoia about secrecy, refusing detailed publication of their methods while still welcoming Chanute's input. Chanute served as a clearinghouse for aeronautical knowledge, even sharing confidential data from Samuel Langley with Wilbur. This information exchange proved invaluable, though Wilbur would eventually realize he needed to break free from established thinking to find his own answers. When Chanute visited the Wright home on Hawthorne Street, he likely encouraged Wilbur to publish more details about his work. This led to Wilbur's presentation to the Western Society of Engineers in Chicago in September 1901, a speech that would become foundational in aeronautics. Despite his nervousness, Wilbur delivered some aeronautical experiments with confidence, distinguishing himself by focusing on controlled flight rather than mere power. He dramatically demonstrated flight's instability by dropping paper that twisted erratically, explaining that flying required mastering this instability. Using a horse training analogy, he explained his empirical approach. If you are looking for perfect safety, you will do well to sit on a fence and watch the birds. But if you really wish to learn, you must mount a machine and become acquainted with its tricks by actual trial. The attendees left filled with wonder, talking about Wilbur Wright, not the Wright brothers. Most didn't even know Wilbur had a brother. Chanute knew who would truly solve flight, and it wasn't Orville. This presentation marked Wilbur's emergence as a respected voice in the aeronautical community, establishing him as the intellectual force behind the Wright brothers' work. The brothers' critical innovation came in 1902 with the addition of a hinged rudder connected to the wing warping cradle, a development that would prove revolutionary in aviation history. This elegant solution provided control over all three axes of flight. The elevator controlled pitch, up and down movement, wing warping managed roll, tilting side to side, and the rudder handled yaw, turning left or right. This three-axis control system remains fundamental to aircraft design even today. A colorful legend emerged about the discovery's origins, claiming that Orville, after an evening of excessive coffee consumption, experienced a sudden revelation about the hinged rudder concept. According to this tale, he anxiously approached Wilbur the following morning, anticipating skepticism or rejection. Instead, Wilbur not only embraced the idea, but enhanced it by suggesting they connect the rudder's movement to their existing wing warping mechanism, creating an integrated control system. Historical records, however, paint a different picture. In Wilbur's patent deposition, he consistently used plural pronouns and described the breakthrough as emerging from their joint experimental work. This aligns more closely with their established pattern of collaborative problem-solving and methodical testing. Their success at Kitty Hawk in 1902 was remarkable, completing approximately 250 glides in just 10 days, an unprecedented achievement that caught the attention of the aviation community. Even Secretary Langley of the Smithsonian Institution, despite his own competing efforts, requested to observe their trials. Upon returning to Dayton, they made a crucial decision to hire Charlie Taylor to manage their bicycle business. Taylor, despite having only a seventh-grade education, possessed extraordinary mechanical intuition and problem-solving abilities. His contribution would prove invaluable. He later constructed the airplane's motor for under $100, using primarily hand tools and raw materials. This stood in stark contrast to the thousands of dollars others were spending on engine development. The Wright brothers' approach exemplified efficient innovation through careful observation and incremental improvement. While Samuel Langley of the Smithsonian invested $50,000 in government funds on elaborate flying machines that repeatedly crashed into the Potomac River, the Wrights maintained a modest budget of less than $1,000. Their success stemmed from a fundamental insight that eluded their competitors. Controlling flight was more critical than raw power. They recognized that stability and maneuverability were the keys to sustained flight, while others focused primarily on generating enough thrust to lift their machines off the ground. This period marked the transition from theoretical possibilities to practical aviation, with the Wright systematic approach and breakthrough control system laying the foundation for modern flight. Their work demonstrated that successful innovation often comes not from lavish funding or complex solutions, but from deep understanding of fundamental principles and methodical experimentation. On December 17, 1903, with the wind blowing at 20 miles per hour, the Wright brothers prepared for their historic attempt at powered flight. They laid the track 100 feet west of camp, facing the freezing wind. Wilbur positioned his Gundlach Corona V camera 30 feet from the rail's end, instructing John Daniels to press the bulb as the flyer passed, their only chance to prove they had flown. The historic photograph captured by Daniels would supersede any account Wilbur could put forward and became powerful evidence that the Wright brothers were equal contributors. In reality, Orville's 12-second flight lacked proper control, as he later admitted in his diary. "I found the control of the front rudder quite difficult. A sudden dart went out about 100 feet from the end of the track ended the flight. It was essentially a controlled crash, with Orville nosing back into the sand a second after the photo was taken." It wasn't until Wilbur's final flight of almost a minute that the first truly controlled powered flight occurred, the true 59 seconds during which man had tamed the air. Wilbur's untimely death would later obscure the truth that he had been the guiding force behind breaking the mystery of flight. After Wilbur's final flight, a sudden gust of wind struck the machine as they discussed their achievement. all rushed to stop it from turning over, but were too late. John Daniels, caught inside, was turned over with the flyer, but amazingly wasn't hurt. The plane was wrecked, engine legs broken, chain guides bent, uprights and ribs broken. The damaged flyer would never fly again. Remarkably, the world largely ignored the Wright brothers' achievement, a moment that would fundamentally alter human transportation and warfare. The first publication to report their success was the unlikely source of Gleanings in Bee Culture in March 1904, where beekeeper Amos Root described witnessing their flight at Huffman Prairie. His detailed account included precise descriptions of the aircraft's movements and control mechanisms, yet most newspapers dismissed Root's account as fantasy, with Scientific American questioning how such a momentous event could have escaped mainstream reporting if it were true. The media skepticism persisted even in the face of direct evidence. When the telegraph operator in Kitty Hawk broke his promise of secrecy and leaked news of their flight, creating sensational headlines like "Flying Machine Soars 3 Miles," only 5 of 21 newspapers published the story. The Dayton Journal's editor infamously dismissed their 57-second flight as not newsworthy, declaring that 3 minutes would be required for such news to merit coverage. The Wrights eventually issued a carefully worded press release correcting various fabrications about their achievement, but it received little attention in a media landscape fixated on more sensational, though less substantiated, flying machine claims. Facing a critical fork in the road, the Wrights made the bold decision to close their profitable bicycle shop to focus full-time on marketing their invention. Wilbur, particularly pragmatic about their future, knew they needed to monetize their creation despite having no precedent for making money in aviation. This pivotal decision led to an era of intense secrecy as they awaited patent approval while simultaneously trying to prove their achievement to potential buyers in both civilian and military markets. Their protective secrecy, though strategically necessary, bred widespread skepticism throughout the aviation community. The Paris Herald Tribune exemplified the growing doubts with its provocative headline, "Flyers or Liars?" Despite conducting regular flights at Huffman Prairie and completing an impressive 105 flights by 1905, some lasting over 30 minutes and covering distances of over 24 miles, the brothers steadfastly refused to demonstrate without firm purchase offers, fearing theft of their ideas. This stance proved particularly frustrating for the public, as passengers on nearby interurban trains frequently witnessed their flights, yet most dismissed these sightings as elaborate hoaxes or misidentified glider experiments. The brothers' insistence on secrecy created a paradox. They needed to protect their invention while simultaneously proving its existence to secure sales. This challenge was compounded by the emergence of rival aviators in Europe, particularly in France, who were making their own claims about powered flight, though none had achieved the controlled, sustained flight the Wrights had mastered. After receiving their patent in 1906 for new and useful improvements in flying machines, the Wrights essentially controlled aviation, requiring anyone who wanted to fly to sign a license agreement and pay royalties. This led to bitter battles with competitors, particularly Glenn Curtiss, who developed ailerons that many believed were based on the Wrights' wing-warping concept. The contrast between Wilbur's triumphant reception in France in 1908 and his later state tormented him. In Le Mans, Wilbur had demonstrated to 200,000 spectators that he had truly conquered flight. The French had recognized his genius before his own country did. He was celebrated, feted by royalty, and made $200,000 in contracts and prizes. But by 1911, Wilbur was consumed by bitterness over what he perceived as theft of his invention. The patent battle with Curtiss had become an obsession, his first fought in the morning and last at night. He believed anyone who flew an airplane owed him licensing fees, as Judge Hazel had confirmed the validity of the Wright patent covering the 3 axes of control. Even more painful was the betrayal by his mentor, Octave Chanute, who accused Wilbur of being greedy and questioned his legal suits. Chanute claimed wing warping was an ancient art invented in France that Wilbur had merely perfected. Their correspondence grew increasingly bitter, with Chanute suggesting Wilbur's judgment had been warped by the desire for great wealth, and Wilbur responding that he found it most difficult to formulate a precise statement of what you contributed to our success. The friendship couldn't survive, confirming Wilbur's belief that only family could be trusted. Wilbur's health deteriorated as he devoted himself to courtroom battles instead of flying. In 1912, he died from typhoid fever, leaving Orville to carry on alone. Orville would live until 1948, giving him decades to shape their history while struggling with conflicting desires to protect Wilbur's legacy while portraying himself as an equal partner. After Wilbur's death, Orville became the sole voice of the Wright brothers for 36 years. His most significant battle was with the Smithsonian Institution, which had attempted to rehabilitate Samuel Langley's reputation by modifying his failed aircraft and claiming it could have flown before the Wrights. In 1914, Glenn Curtiss, still fighting the Wright patents, collaborated with the Smithsonian to modify Langley's original 1903 aircraft. Curtiss completely transformed the aerodrome, replacing wings with new ones using the correct cord and camber ratios Wilbur had discovered, adding wire trussing, gutting the control system, and installing a yoke and wheel system based on the Wright Flyer's three-axis control. The result was 30% 1903 technology and 70% 1914 technology. Despite these modifications, the Smithsonian published reports claiming the unmodified Langley aerodrome had successfully flown, declaring it the first airplane capable of sustained free flight with a man. They displayed it with a label calling it the first man-carrying aeroplane in the history of the world capable of sustained free flight. This fraud threatened the Wright brothers' legacy. In response, Orville made a dramatic decision. In 1925, he sent the original 1903 Wright Flyer to the Science Museum in London rather than the Smithsonian. When questioned about sending America's aeronautical treasure abroad, Orville explained it was the only way to correct the historical record that had been perverted by the Smithsonian Institution through false and misleading statements. The flyer remained in London through World War II, protected in underground storage as German bombers attacked the city. Only after the Smithsonian formally retracted its claims in 1942, publishing a statement that included both a list of differences between the 1903 Langley aerodrome and the 1914 Hammondsport machine, along with a disavowal of the 1914 Zahm report, did Orville amend his will to allow the flyer's return to America. Fred Kelly's authorized biography of the Wright brothers, published in 1943, created a mythology of perfect brotherhood that persists today. Two equally brilliant men working in perfect synchronicity to solve flight. This sanitized version omits uncomfortable truths. The psychopath who knocked out Wilbur's teeth, sending him into depression. Orville's social limitations, their lifelong bachelorhood living with their sister and father, and Orville's relationship with his secretary Mabel Beck. The reality was far different. Wilbur was the visionary who corresponded extensively with Octave Chanute, presented findings to engineers in Chicago, and first ventured alone to Kitty Hawk. Orville remained content with the bicycle business until pulled into his brother's quest. Wilbur flew first and crashed less, while Orville had two serious crashes, one fatal to his passenger. Bishop Wright's family culture demanded unity against a corrupt world, but Wilbur's superiority occasionally showed through his frustrations with his brother. The famous photograph showing Orville piloting with Wilbur running alongside cemented the myth of equality. But the true breakthrough flight that day was Wilbur's nearly minute-long journey after the photo was taken. The real first controlled human flight accomplished by the true inventor of the airplane. In 1985, engineers determined the 1903 Flyer was so difficult that only the Wright brothers, with their extensive glider training, could have flown it successfully, confirming Wilbur's unique genius as the man truly born to fly. You cannot have co-authors in true visionary work. Someone always leads while another follows. The visionary holds the entire concept in their head and is indispensable, while assistants can be replaced. Had Orville returned to bicycles, someone else could have helped Wilbur. But without Wilbur, flight would not have happened. His genius was irreplaceable, seeing the whole problem while others only solved parts. The Wright brothers' story remains one of America's greatest achievements, but the truth behind the myth reveals a more nuanced tale of one man's vision, supported by a loyal brother who would later become the guardian of their shared legacy. Perhaps this makes their story even more remarkable, not just an achievement of engineering, but a testament to family bonds and the power of a singular mind to change the course of human history.